From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we're still digesting last night's embarrassing and cringe-inducing debate between President Trump and Joe Biden, and it's causing heartburn. Trump is campaigning in Minnesota today, Biden in Pennsylvania, but many Americans are stunned.
Lots to talk about, so let's bring in Domenico Montanaro, NPR's senior political editor. And Domenico, you wrote for NPR today that this was maybe the worst presidential debate in American history, and to that, others have said it was the worst. What happened last night?
Yeah, it just, you know, was just off the rails from almost the beginning of the debate. You know, President Trump made a strategic decision that he was going to be very aggressive and not adhere to the rules of the debate, not let Joe Biden answer questions, not let the moderator ask them. And he just decided that he was going to speak over everyone who was there. And to be honest, to a certain point, it seemed to work, where he looked like he was commanding the stage. It looked like Joe Biden was kind of shirking from the moment and didn't know how to control this guy. But then he kind of went too far and made a couple of pretty egregious moves that went over the line for a lot of people.
Yeah, well, here's one of those key moments. Moderator Chris Wallace asked the president to condemn white supremacists, and he wouldn't do it.
Look, what are you saying?
I'm willing to do anything. I want to see peace.
Then do it, sir.
Say it. Do you want to call him? What do you want to call him? Give me a name.
White supremacists and
right wing. Who would you like me to condemn?
White supremacists and right wing.
Proud Boys, stand back and stand by. But I'll tell you what.
Trump there referring to the far right group Proud Boys, who've, you know, frankly, already taken those words "stand back" and "stand by" literally as a badge of honor. Domenico, what was the significance of that pretty extraordinary moment?
Well, you know, look, for this president, it's all about, you know, how he gathers a coalition to win. You know, there's very little in the way of ethics or morality that he tries to hold up. If it goes against his potential loss of a voter, he won't go there. So it's very difficult for him, because for him, his sense of things is, The problems in cities as left-wing groups, I'm not going to be trapped into saying that, you know, I'm going to condemn these other people. But he fails to realize that he's the president of the United States, and they have to set a moral boundary about what's appropriate and what's not. And this group is now using Trump's words as part of a new logo. You know, in addition to that, President Trump declined to tell his supporters that they should be patient when vote comes in, and not to resort to violence. He wouldn't even say that. And the lowest blow was when Joe Biden was talking about his late son Beau's military service, that Trump went in on Biden's other son Hunter and brought up his past cocaine use. And it really backfired, because in what was really an unplanned moment for Biden, this is something he doesn't really like talking about. He's been very private about Hunter's drug use in the past. He turned it into something he rarely talks about, and made it a positive, sympathetic moment, spoke to the camera, said he's proud of his son for having overtaken the addiction.
Right. In fact, you wrote today that Biden actually, aside from that moment, that he missed some opportunities in this debate. How do you think he handled himself through that barrage from President Trump?
Well, look, it's very difficult. I don't know how anyone in particular could, you know, deal with something that is so outside the bounds of how a debate is supposed to go. I mean, let's remember 200,000 Americans have died from the coronavirus. And instead of having a sober, reasoned debate on the direction of the country and how to handle a pandemic, we're talking about all this chaos and mud that got thrown at the wall by President Trump. With Biden, you know, some of the opportunities he kind of missed, you know, when talking about masks, for example, President Trump was talking about how he's somewhat okay with them. He doesn't know. And he claimed that his rallies caused no harm. You know, Biden could have interjected and pointed out that the spiking coronavirus cases that took place after Trump's Tulsa, Oklahoma rally, for example. Hmm. You know, Joe Biden is just not the debater he was a decade ago. I mean, it's pretty clear he's not as crisp. He's, you know, he was flummoxed at times last night when President Trump was doing what he was doing. And that was the idea from President Trump. The problem is, Joe Biden's issue positions line up with the middle of the country more so than President Trump's does. And Biden's strategy that helped him was to create moments where he could look directly to the camera and have a soundbite. And he did come away with some of those last night.
To your point about Biden's positioning within the party, I want to listen to this next clip. It starts out a discussion about health care. Let's listen.
What I proposed is that we expand Obamacare and we increase it. We do not wipe any. And one of the big debates we had with 23 of my colleagues trying to win the nomination that I won were saying that Biden wanted to allow people to have private insurance still. They can. They do. They will under my proposal.
It's not what you've said, but, and it's not what your party has said.
That is simply
your party
a lie.
Doesn't say it. Your party wants to go socialist medicine.
My party is
and
me.
Socialist
right
healthcare.
Now, I am,
and
the
they're
going to
dominate
party.
You, Joe. You know that.
I am the
Domenico.
Democratic
President
party.
Trump repeatedly throughout this debate tried to tie Biden to the left wing of the Democratic Party. We heard Biden right there say, "I am the Democratic Party." What did you make of his efforts to resist that characterization?
Well, I don't think much of that stood from President Trump to land on Joe Biden. None of it has so far. And Biden just repeated the positions he has that you can look up on his website, that he talks about on the campaign trail, that he mentioned in each of the Democratic debates. The reason why he had such a tough time in the Democratic debates was because he was fighting progressives on one side who wanted to push him to, you know, be more progressive on especially health care or climate change. And he resisted, especially on healthcare, wanting a public option rather than Medicare for all, and still has continued to stick to that. And there were some just odd moments where President Trump would say he won't even say law and order. And then Biden did say law and order, and he said law and order with justice where people are treated fairly. And then Trump continued to say he won't say law and order and tweeted
Domenico,
it even this morning. So it just doesn't make much sense.
Domenico Montanaro, thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Well, last night was maybe a landmark in American politics. We'll take it up again today. But first, fires are burning in California. In Napa and Sonoma County, the Glass Fire continues its rampage through wine country. In Shasta County, the state is calling for backup for the Zog Fire. Alice Wolfley has been reporting for KQED. And Alice, we know the Zog and Glass Fires are just two of nearly 30 that are burning. Start with the Zog. What's the latest?
Well, in the far northern part of the state, the Zog Fire has burned more than 50,000 acres, and steep, rugged terrain up there is making containment difficult. Firefighters are continuing to focus on saving homes and other buildings. And then the Glass Fire, it's just 2% contained, and it's burned more than 48,000 acres. Firefighters will be putting their energy towards securing that fire line. There is some good news in the Glass Fire that in Santa Rosa, the city of Santa Rosa, some evacuations were downgraded. And one other thing that's been happening during these fires up here is there's more information available in Spanish than there has been in past years. I spoke to a CAL FIRE spokesperson who was able to give interviews in both English and Spanish. And there are Spanish speakers at the evacuation centers and also answering the public information phone lines. And this is incredibly important for the large Spanish-speaking community here.
Yeah, and much of them work in places like Harry and David's, you know, people who enjoy that product. You know, many of its workers are being hit hard by these fires. Thousands of people have had to flee, some for the second or third time. What are you hearing from them? Is there a sense some might not go back?
The evacuees I spoke with in Napa County said they had already been evacuated at least once this summer. They'd all been evacuated before previous times. I spoke with one man who said evacuation has become a ritual for his family. He said he'd been evacuated 4 times this year. He said he loves where he lives, but he's thinking seriously about moving his family somewhere else. And I have heard the same thing from many other evacuees.
And what about the weather? We mentioned high temperatures, wind advisories. How does the weather factor into this?
Well, there's a fire weather watch in effect beginning tomorrow through Friday, and that may be upgraded to a fire warning, what we call red flag alerts, which means extreme fire danger. High temperatures and low humidity continue. They're expected through the end of the week, and there is no rain in the forecast for the near future.
And so when they say firefighters are asking for help, from where?
Well, we have firefighters coming in from all over the country and all over the state. I saw firefighters, local firefighters coming in from surrounding small volunteer departments and departments in large cities. So it's the mutual aid agreements are very strong and continue to persist all over California. There's more than 18,000 people fighting fires in California right now.
Well, we remember some California firefighters went to Australia, so it's global as well. Alice, just briefly, we know you've lived there the most of your life, just bought a home. Do you ever consider, you know, whether you can build a future there?
You know, I love California. It's my home, and I didn't think there was anything that could get me to leave the state. But in recent years, with what's been going on with the fires, it's gotten so much worse. And we just lived through more than 4 weeks of smoke here in the Bay Area. And I don't want to leave, but my commitment to staying in the state might not be as strong as it was a few years ago.
Alice Wolfley, reporter for KQED in San Francisco. Alice, thanks as always.
Thank you.
In last night's debate, there was a lot of blame for the economy crawling to a halt. Not a lot of discussion about how to help it reopen safely and help workers get back in. In some parts of the country, whole sectors, health clubs, office buildings, schools, restaurants, movie theaters, and clubs are only slowly reopening. So what are the rights of people who work at these businesses? Can you decide it's not safe? Will you get fired if you don't feel it is? What about employers? What are their responsibilities and what are their rights? If a worker wants to continue to work from home, but an employer feels it's not productive, can they force them to go in? Sharon Block is executive director of the Labor and Work-Life Program at Harvard Law School. She joins us now to wade through so many questions. Professor Block, welcome.
Thank you.
Start with, you know, there are parts of the country where states and jurisdictions are not requiring people to wear masks. But if a worker feels that's the only safe way to go back to work, is an employer required to provide that safety for their worker?
So employers are required under the law to provide what we refer to as a safe and healthful workplace for all their employees. Ordinarily, you would expect that the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, which is the federal agency responsible for enforcing that responsibility for employers, to have answered questions like this, to tell employers, you know, what they believe is necessary for them to provide a safe and healthful workplace under these conditions. Unfortunately, that hasn't happened. OSHA has provided them with some voluntary guidance. CDC has put guidance out. There are lots of sources of information, but in terms of what workers have a right to expect, it's sadly a very difficult question to answer at this point.
Yeah. If a worker doesn't feel they're safe, can they demand that they work from home?
Workers always have a right to refuse to work in a workplace that poses an imminent threat to them. You know, you have to know the particular circumstances, but it seems in light of how serious it is to get COVID, that if a worker feels like they are not being protected in the workplace, that qualifies.
And if they don't have a union, do they just go to OSHA as you normally would if you don't feel safe in a workplace?
Right. This is where it gets tricky. Yes, they should go to their employer. They should express these concerns. They should say what the grounds for those concerns are, and they should document all of that. If their employer does not fix the situation and insists that they go to work, again, they can refuse to do that. They should file a complaint with OSHA. In many states, there's a state government agency that also looks at public health and at occupational safety and health. So they should let their state public health agency know. You also have federally protected rights when you stand together with your coworkers, even if you're not in a union. So to the extent that this is a common concern among workers, it's always a good idea to go together to your employer and stand up together.
Yeah. Well, and you also have the avenue of a lawsuit. Earlier this month, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell introduced legislation to protect employers against these suits, again, from people, you know, feeling that they're not safe.
So a few responses to that. First, I haven't seen the evidence that there has been some huge uptick in lawsuits brought by workers against their employers. And in fact, workers have very few ways of bringing lawsuits against their employers because in every state except Texas, employers are covered by workers' comp systems. And under workers' comp, workers actually aren't allowed to sue their employers if they get sick on the job unless the employer acts really outrageously. So there's actually the opposite problem, which is workers trying to get protections under workers' comp to get compensation, and employers fighting with them and dragging out litigation over whether they actually got exposed on the job or not. As of right now, there have been thousands and thousands of complaints to OSHA by workers. And for the most part, OSHA is just telling employers, do your best with no follow-up. And then only a very, very like single-digit handful of actual citations being issued against employers, despite the fact that hundreds or thousands of workers have died on the job from COVID.
Well, I'm thinking about meatpacking places and things like
exactly.
that. Well, lawsuits have been successful in at least one case we're reading about in Dallas. A restaurant had a no-mask policy. They were insisting that their workers not wear masks. There was a kitchen worker who violated that, wore a mask, and they stopped giving her hourly shifts because, again, they had a no-mask policy, and a judge ruled in her favor. So there can be that avenue.
Yes, there can be. But generally, it is difficult for workers to be able to bring those kinds of cases. But, you know, if you think of the circumstances that like frontline workers find themselves in, you know, we're in the midst of a pandemic, we're in the midst of a recession that is hitting low wage workers in just almost unprecedented ways, right, with tens of millions of workers still unemployed. The idea that workers have got to go out and find a lawyer and navigate this complicated legal system in order to stick up for themselves, to be safe on the job, it is hard to imagine that the biggest problem we're going to have as our economy yeah. opens up more and more is that too many workers figure that out as a means to protect themselves. I
right.
mean, sadly, well, it's much more common that they can't.
What about employers? The ones who understand that they have to keep their workplaces safe. Can workers be told you have to wear a mask?
You know, I do believe that most employers want to do the right thing. So they can, in fact, make a condition of the job that workers do what's necessary to keep everybody in the workplace safe and healthy.
What about if a worker just doesn't feel safe coming back? Maybe they have a compromised immune system. Maybe they're older. Can an employer tell them, you have to come back? It's not productive. We can't afford you working from home. It doesn't work for our bottom line.
So again, we come back to the fact that workers can't be forced to work in an unsafe workplace. Now, it gets complicated if they're not, you know, if they truly can't do the job, even with proper protections, then, you know, you look at whether they can be provided paid sick time to be able to address, you know, if they're quarantining or they have somebody in their family who's quarantining and so they have to take care of them or who's sick. You certainly hope in most circumstances that employers and employees can figure out together.
Right.
But then we also have all of these different supports for people who truly can't work because of the pandemic that Congress passed. Sadly, some of them have expired. Others are going to expire if Congress doesn't renew them. They should be able to get unemployment insurance under these different programs, even if they wouldn't have been able to get it in normal circumstances. But again, these are proving to be very difficult processes for workers to navigate in many states. There are backlogs. And since the summer, there's this threat hanging over all of these programs that they will run out.
Well, just that, I wanted to ask you, at one point, people who had to stay home to take care of their children, there was the Families First Coronavirus Response Act passed in March, and employers had to pay for up to 12 weeks at two-thirds of your regular pay if you had to care for a child. Is that still an option?
I think it is, but again, there's concern about when that is going to run out. But yes, if you have to stay home because you're, you know, because you have these responsibilities that are directly related to the pandemic, there are supports in place.
Can an employer tell a worker, we don't want you coming back in because you're older or pregnant and we don't want to be responsible?
No. I mean, what the employer needs to do is to provide each of their workers a safe and healthful workplace. So the employer would need to analyze the situation, say, how do my work processes work? What do my employees do? How can I make sure that I'm providing the PPE that they need? And so making some kind of blanket determination because you're pregnant, because you're older, I'm not going to do the kinds of measures that are necessary to keep you safe on the job. An employer can't do that.
Sharon Block, anything else you want us to know? We know you have a report that you've co-authored called Clean Slate. It has recommendations for all employees. We'll link people to it. But, you know, can you tick off other things you'd like people going back to the workforce to know?
My belief is that workers often know more about their workplace than anybody else. And so I think the best possible path forward for employers who want to do the right thing is to listen to your workers. Ask what they think can make them safe and comfortable on the job, or what support do they need to be able to do their jobs from home, and sort of navigate this together.
We understand the CDC also has some recommendations, you know, no handshaking, wash hands, wash down doorknobs and things that might get touched a lot.
Yep, there is good information out there. A lot of unions, worker organizations, CDC, state and local governments are stepping up to try to fill in this void. So that's great advice. I think there is a lot of good information out there for employers and workers who want to work together on figuring this out.
That's Sharon Block, Executive Director of the Labor and Work-Life Program at Harvard Law School. Professor Block, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
So here's another lawsuit. It was from a Kentucky funeral home president against the company which owned the home. The funeral home president says she was fired by the company for following state recommendations on size limits at a funeral. She was limiting the number of people who could attend per her state, and she was fired. The lawsuit was settled privately out of court. In other words, she won. Your work experience. Welcome here. Hereandnow.org. And let's get back now to President Trump's refusal to condemn white supremacy last night. He didn't when moderator Chris Wallace asked him to. Then he asked Wallace to name a specific group. Joe Biden yelled out Proud Boys, the far-right club. Let's listen.
Give me a name. Give me a
name. White supremacists and
white supremacists
and right
Proud Boys. Stand back and stand by, but I'll tell you what.
Well, afterwards, the Proud Boys made a badge with those words, and Proud Boys organizer Joe Biggs said on the platform parlor to the chair of the group, Enrique Tarrio, Trump basically just told us to, I'll paraphrase, go mess them up. This makes me so happy. Enrique's message, seemingly back to the president, was, standing by, sir. CNN's Ellie Reeve has done great reporting on the Proud Boys. Ellie, you tell us Proud Boys is an organization with a chairman. They have chapters. They have a ritual in which I think they get punched in the face five times in order to join. This is an official group.
Yes, this is a real group. They have chapters. They have logos and patches, and that seems to be part of the appeal, to dress up your body armor in the logos of the group.
As opposed to Antifa, which, according to U.S. intelligence, is more of an ideology, people who are anti-fascism but loosely organized and thought to be much smaller in number. So this group stands for what?
Well, that's interesting. You know, they kind of keep it difficult to pin down. It's one of the many groups of the Trump era that is influenced by the culture of the internet. So there's a lot of irony, and there's a big gap between the superficial meaning of the things they say and the implied meaning. So they are not explicit white supremacists. Instead, they say, we want to defend Western culture. And if you say, well, is that code for white culture? They'll say, oh, well, you're the racist. You think Black people can't be part of Western culture? So, like, they work very hard to keep their critics on the defensive. But in the end, it doesn't actually matter that much trying to go through what they say with a fine-tooth comb, because what they do is a lot more important. They go to these rallies and they get in fights. They parade around with weapons. They intentionally are projecting this kind of authoritarian image. And I think that's quite unsettling.
And you have had conversations. You went to a Proud Boys rally recently in Portland, and we know that you spoke to the chairman of the group, Enrique Tarrio, last night. What did he say about the president's comments?
He said his phone was blowing up. He said that he welcomed Trump's mention and that he was proud of his group for getting it, but that he didn't see it as an endorsement. And he said that he took the words stand back and stand by as an order to let the police do their job.
He says a lot of things to you that are sort of winking in the interviews mm-hmm. I've seen between the two of you. Did you get the sense that this was a wink?
That's the thing about this culture, right? You can never pin it down. So again, I think it's important to just look at what they do. There have been many Proud Boys who have gotten in legal trouble for getting in fights with anti-fascists. So they might say that they don't want to engage in that. I think we'll see ahead of the election what actually happens.
CNN's Ellie Reeve, who's done terrific deep reporting on Proud Boys. Ellie, thank you.
Oh, thanks so much.
And let's stay with our top story today by taking a moment to fact-check some of the many claims made at last night's debate. NPR political reporter Danielle Kurtzleben has been doing just that. Danielle, welcome.
Danielle. Hey there.
A lot to sort through. Let's start with something that came up at the end of the debate. Here's President Trump talking about ballot security.
They're sending millions of ballots all over the country. There's fraud. They found them in creeks. They found some with the name Trump. Just happened to have the name Trump just the other day in a waste paper basket. They're being sent all over the place. They sent two in a Democrat area. They sent out 1,000 ballots. Everybody got two ballots. This is going to be a fraud like you've never seen.
Okay, everyone, repeat after me. There has been rarely any ballot mail-in fraud in United States history. The president formed a commission to study it after the 2016 election, which had to be disbanded. There was so little. This is not accurate. But what are you hearing here, Danielle?
Well, what he's doing is he's leaning on that wastebasket claim that he made, which is based in fact in one incident, to be clear. That claim seems to be about 9 military ballots found in a wastebasket in a county in Pennsylvania. Now, what happened there? An election official found those ballots. It's under investigation, and the worker who threw them away was fired. And it is true that a majority of those ballots had Trump's name on them. But what he's doing is, as you said, taking that claim and blowing it up and trying to make something much bigger about it. He said something about ballots in creeks and rivers. I looked into it. Other fact checkers have looked into it. It's unclear what he was saying about those. But look, what he's doing here is he's fear-mongering about this election being rife with fraud. And as you said, proven instances of fraud in presidential elections are exceedingly rare. And people have been voting by mail for a long time. And just to add here that he's potentially setting the stage to question the results of the election. And he's eroding faith in the electoral process. I want to just stress here, that is breathtaking from a sitting president. This is a huge deal.
Well, he also was telling his backers to go to the polls. And that's voter intimidation. That's, you know, that's illegal. So that may be taken up again. But let's listen to something else. The president also spoke about transfers of power between administrations. He made this unverified claim about 2016.
There's been no transition from when I won. I won that election. And if you look at crooked Hillary Clinton, if you look at all of the different people, there was no transition because they came after me trying to do a coup. They came after me spying on my campaign.
Danielle, important because President Trump shocked people when he expressed doubt about whether he would agree to a peaceful transfer of power. So your thoughts on this comment here?
Right. Well, once again, I will say that part of this, I couldn't make heads or tails of what he meant by there was no transition in 2016. Hillary Clinton lost. She conceded. President Trump took office. That's what happened. He is in office. But when he's talking about his campaign being spied upon, he seems to not be talking about Clinton, but about President Obama, whom Trump has baselessly said spied on his campaign. That is not true. Now, the FBI under Obama did surveil the Trump campaign, and the reason they did so was the Trump campaign's contacts with Russians. They were investigating Russian interference in the election. But there was an FBI report done after that saying that the FBI did not find political motivations. They didn't find, broadly speaking, anything untoward or improper. They did find some problems with the investigation, though, and the Trump administration and campaign have seized on those.
Okay. Well, of course, the biggest headline of the night came when President Trump was asked if he would condemn white supremacists and militia groups. He didn't. He said kind of, I want peace and everything, but he never said I condemn them. We just spoke a few minutes ago about the Proud Boys, who he also would not condemn, how they reacted to that. But then he went on to say that the problem was actually on the left. Let's listen.
Somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left, because this is not a right-wing problem. This is a left-wing
problem.
This is a left-wing problem.
White supremacist. Antifa's an idea, not an organization.
Oh, you got it.
Not malicious. That's what his FBI, his FBI director said.
Well, then you know what?
No, no, we're done, sir.
But they probably weren't. But Danielle, what are you hearing there? Yeah.
All right, so let's start with the president's claim that the problem in some of these protests has been on the left. Now, we did see, as we saw earlier this summer, there was rioting during and after some of these protests. And in recent years, yes, there have been instances of violence among protesters on the left. But that said, to claim it's that all of the violence amid this unrest that we've seen is among people on the left is false. I mean, for example, here's a high-profile example. In Kenosha this summer, you had Kyle Rittenhouse, that 17-year-old who seems to have shot two protesters. Rittenhouse does not seem to be a person who is on the left. Furthermore, these protests are about police brutality, police-instigated violence. So, I mean, there have been a lot of instances of violence from many people.
No. By the way, we have a terrific piece at our website about what exactly is Antifa. And you can listen there for more as well. But I want to jump ahead, Danielle, to some words from Joe Biden and the topic of the economy and manufacturing. Let's listen to this claim from Vice President Biden.
We handed him a booming economy. He blew it.
It wasn't
he
booming.
Blew it. He blew it.
It wasn't booming. It was the weakest recovery since 1929.
Is it fair to say he blew it when there was record low unemployment before COVID?
Yeah, but because what he did, even before COVID, manufacturing went in the hole.
Okay, Danielle, let's take this piece by piece. Jobs in manufacturing, key to the president's reelection message. Was manufacturing down in a hole just before COVID hit?
That doesn't seem to really be true. Now, manufacturing had taken a massive hit in the Great Recession before and during the Obama administration. And it did start climbing. That climb continued during the Trump administration. The best you could say, looking purely at employment in manufacturing here, is that it plateaued somewhat just before the COVID recession. It maybe fell off a teeny bit. I don't know if you could call that a hole, though. So on that particular discrete claim, I don't know if you could quite say that's true.
What about Biden's larger claim that President Obama handed President Trump an economy that was growing?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was true. I mean, look, President Obama presided over that massive recession and then a long stretch of private sector job growth, the longest in history, which the Obama administration often trumpeted. Now, there are interesting flip sides to this, because President Trump last night and many other times has said, well, that was the slowest recession ever, slowest since the Great Depression. It is definitely the slowest since World War II, by the way. But the question is, you know, on the other hand, it was such a deep hole, perhaps it just took a long time to get out of it. And that, you know, given the nature of a housing crisis, how difficult it was to get credit flowing again, that, yeah, it might have understandably taken a long time. So there is so much nuance to get at there. But long story short, to get back to what you were asking, the economy was growing when President Obama left office and President Trump took office. And it is true that early in President Trump's term, before COVID, the economy was still growing. You can make arguments about was it growing for everyone? That is another nuance here. But yes, it was growing.
Definitely was growing. Quick on the pandemic, I think we have about a minute here. President Trump made this claim about what Joe Biden would do if he became president.
This guy will close down the whole country and destroy our country. Our country is coming back incredibly well, setting records as it does it. We don't need somebody to come in and say, let's shut it down.
Did Joe Biden say, let's shut it down?
There is a big caveat here. What Biden has said here, he said this in an August interview with CBS, is that he would shut it down if scientists recommend it. And this plays into a bigger theme that Biden was really trying to get at last night. That theme was, I will listen to legitimate scientists. So if scientists, so Biden was saying, if scientists tell me we have to shut down the whole country in order to get the economy back, to get us all healthy, I will do that. But there's a huge if there.
Yeah. Boy, I tell you, even listening back to parts of this, my stomach is roiling. This, you got a couple seconds here. It was ugly.
It most definitely was. This, I mean, I am not the first or the last person to say this. This was the wildest and most messiest, I think is maybe the best word I can come up with, debate I've seen.
Well, thanks for going over it with us. NPR political reporter Danielle Kurtzleben, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
And we're going to step away from last night's debate to ask, what's going on in Iraq? Relations between the U.S. and the Iraqi government are fraying right now. There are threats from the U.S. to close the embassy in Baghdad after a series of attacks targeting the American presence in that country. Washington blames the attacks, including one that killed Iraqi civilians on Monday, on Iranian-backed militia groups and is threatening to close its embassy in Baghdad, one of the largest American diplomatic missions in the world. NPR's Jane Arraf is following this story from Amman, Jordan. Jane, you know, with all the other news, listeners might be thinking, Iraq, I thought that was over. What's going on there now?
Yeah, that's the thing about Iraq. It's never over. So there have been attacks on the U.S. embassy, attacks on Iraqi convoys that are moving U.S. military equipment, attacks on the airport, including one that fell short and landed on a house, killing women and children. So a lot of attacks that not just the U.S., but other countries say have been increasing, not just in frequency, but in sophistication.
Well, and who is carrying them out that we know? Is it armed groups backed by Iran?
Iran denies it, and unusually Iran-backed militias that want the U.S. to leave and would normally be delighted at this have condemned a lot of those attacks. They're not very popular, but the attacks that keep killing Iraqi civilians, for instance, when they're aiming at U.S. and other targets. Iran has informed the Iraqis that it has no connection with the factions carrying out the attacks, but those waters are really muddy because while Iran does back and fund and control a lot of the major militias, it also has ties with some of the smaller militias, but not all of those militias are under anyone's control, really. The U.S., though, is convinced that Iran is behind it, and Iraq is concerned as well. The Iraqi foreign minister recently went to Tehran to basically tell the Iranians that Iraq cannot afford this, that they can't have a proxy war between the U.S. and Iran going on in Iraq.
Yeah. So the threat from the Trump administration to close the U.S. embassy there, how real is that?
Yeah, that's a great question. The foreign minister, Fawad Hussein, held a press conference today after meeting ambassadors, and he referred to it as an initial decision by the U.S., one presumably that could be reversed in his mind if Iraq fulfills the conditions set by the U.S. and other countries. American officials themselves, U.S. officials, aren't talking, but it's clear that this is a very real threat, because today, for instance, the U.S. ambassador and 24 other ambassadors and heads of diplomatic missions got together to meet with the prime minister to discuss the issue. That doesn't happen unless something is very real.
Well, how is the Iraqi government, how is, you know, the prime minister that we know responding to this?
So they're deeply, deeply concerned because it wouldn't just be the loss of the U.S. embassy and everything that entails, the programs that are run out of here, the connections that Iraq actually values aside from the military connections. It would lead to a lot of other embassies probably closing down if the U.S. feels that it's no longer safe to be in Baghdad. In fact, the prime minister's spokesman told reporters that if the U.S. embassy closes, it would be disastrous. Let's just listen to a bit of that.
الحكومة ملتزمة أفق مواثيق الدولية معاهدات فيينا بتأمين
That's spokesman Ahmed Mullah Talal, and he's saying that if the U.S. pulled out, it would leave Iraq as diplomatically isolated as it was in the days of Saddam Hussein. And in those days, there was no U.S. embassy. A lot of countries didn't have representation there. The foreign minister is also saying that it would be disastrous. And even more than that, he says those who think that closing the American embassy would be a victory, those Iran-backed groups and other Iraqis, he says they're actually delusional, that it would be a disaster for the country.
You know, Jane, something you just said pierced my heart, that this might put us back where we were when Saddam Hussein was leader of Iraq. And we know, you know, the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003 based on faulty intelligence, that Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. He did not, that he was a friend, a supporter of Osama bin Laden. They were bitter enemies. And all that was lost, 5,000 American troops died there, hundreds of thousands of Iraqi soldiers and civilians. So, you know, we know President Trump wants to disentangle America from all conflicts in the Middle East, but what do you see there?
So it wasn't that long ago, actually just a few weeks ago, that the U.S. announced that it was pulling out about 2,000 troops from Iraq. But this will have a very different effect if it actually happens, because not only will it remove a lot of the influence that the U.S. had, it will actually open the door further for Iran to come in. At the moment, Iraq is not an entirely stable place. It has a dysfunctional government. It has militias running wild in some places. And it has a new government that's trying very hard to address all of this. And when they wanted help from the United States, what they feel they're getting is a threat that could plunge it back into that dark period.
Jane Arraf and Aman Jordan speaking of Iraq. Jane, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.
With cold weather coming in some parts, restaurants are scrambling for ways to keep customers outside. A Colorado restaurant will debut yurts next time, Here and Now.